This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, welcome to The Morning Run. I'm Sharad Kutan and with me, Tan Chun Han. Good morning, Han.
Good morning, Sharad, and well done there for pronouncing my name correctly.
Yeah, even I understand even you have difficulty doing that.
No.
Is it
much
a vicious rumour, is it?
Yes, very much vicious. Okay.
We have an exciting lineup for you this morning on The Breakfast Grill. Han speaks to Philip Smith, CEO of Zurich Insurance Malaysia. What kind of issues are you going to be bringing up in the 8 o'clock grill?
Well, essentially, I do want to get his thoughts on Bank Negara's recent report on the state of the domestic insurance sector. You know, for example, Bank Negara talks about how the overall insurance penetration rate has been flat at 54% to 56% for the last 5 years. So essentially, just over half of all Malaysians have insurance. Now, so we're going to talk to Zurich Malaysia and find out why that low figure, and does that relatively low figure, you know, present opportunities for players like Zurich to then, you know, expand their, you know, basically, I guess, expand their business here, right? And then also you've got, say, the central bank, you know, pushing this agenda to try to eliminate the middleman, so to speak, and try to make basic insurance products more available through direct distribution channels. So that's a big part of the agenda for this year. So we're also going to talk about how Zurich will be adapting to those kind of push from the regulators, again, making those basic products available through direct channels, basically online. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, that's fascinating because, you know, as somebody who's like, tried to buy life insurance and all that, I remember it as being a really bureaucratic process. You meet somebody, right. He brings these long forms to be filled in. A lot of ambiguity around the questions that are asked about, your lifestyle and the risk taking that you might have. And so none of it is, and it's posed in a way that it makes you think, you know, over and over again about exactly what is it that you do in your life that might constitute, you know, a danger. Or if you say sign off and saying no, you don't, you know, have risky behavior, then, which is not defined, then the question really becomes, well, you know, later on, can they cancel your policy?
Yeah.
And so there are all these things that I think of the industry as rather moribund, not moribund, but, you know, full of these rather arcane rules that aren't very friendly to somebody like myself as a consumer.
Now, that is interesting that you said that, because also as part of Bank Negara's press release from just a couple of weeks ago, they talk about how they want to help insurance players make this shift to plain language policies. So basically making it a whole lot easier for the average layman to understand what they're signing up for. You know? And they actually have a timeline. So by the end of this year, they expect more than 3/4 of all insurance and takaful policies, to be simplified using plain language. I mean, I don't know how you define plain language, you know, and but
well,
yeah.
Well, I think plain language is what we speak, and not plain language.
I don't know about
is
you,
what
man.
A legal document might be.
So I mean, legalese.
Yeah, you know, and you can tell. I mean, it'd be interesting if there was an attempt to do the same for, say, the legal profession, you know, so legal documents are written in plain language rather than in the kind of the legalese, not just the terms, but actually the syntax of, you know, legal documents that often are bewildering to anybody who even has a, you know, kind of passing familiarity with English language. So, that's a very interesting step too.
Citing the experience that you had when signing up for your insurance products, so that is something that is weighing very much on the minds of not just the central bank, but also industry players like Zurich and others, because, you know, essentially you've got these, on one hand, you can see the need for it. You know, these insurance agents can build upon their network. You know, it is a side income for them. But at the same time, that also translates to costs for these insurance players, right? So the idea is if you can offer more of these products via the direct channel, then you get to, you know, perhaps lower your overheads, right?
Okay. I look forward to this grill because I think that I have a lot to learn about, you know, what somebody like myself, you know, already, you know, in his 50s could possibly gain from understanding what's out there for someone like me, I mean, within my demographic.
And perhaps, you know, avoid those awkward first date-like meetings and grills, you know, with the insurance agent. It's like,
yeah, they're
so intrusive. You know, they want to know everything about you.
Absolutely.
And I just met you.
That's right. Anyway, so because that's at 8 o'clock and go on from 8 to 8.30. Now, after the 8.30 news, we have current affairs. And today we take a closer look at the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia's plans to open a counter-terrorism center in Malaysia and its implications of their soft power approach to fighting IS, the Islamic State or Daesh, in Southeast Asia and beyond. So we have guests from the Rajaratnam School of International Studies, Haziq Ajani, and also Scott Lucas from Birmingham University.
Yeah, and that'll be an interesting one because, you know, this this pushback against the rise of these extremist factions and the ideology being spread in our part of the world, it has been noted by other global powers as well. You know, for example, with our Prime Minister, Dato' Sri Najib Tun Razak, being in India right now, there were reports about how India wants to know about Malaysia's de-radicalization plan. So, again, you know, essentially tempering the kind of, IS or Daesh-related ideology that's being permeated around here.
So we have a little clip from that interview that's going to come up after the 8.30 news.
Intentionally wants to create terrorist group all around the world. Their intention is totally different. They want to make sure that there's a form of Islam that they can anchor on to influence in terms of soft power, diplomacy and so on. But the money that they send over to these countries, I'm not sure the level of checks they have in place to make sure that the money is used in a proper way. A lot of times what happens is that money comes in, as long as they preach a certain kind of Islam, the financiers will be happy about it, and that's the end of the story. But they don't know. For instance, we've been trying to tell them that students of these groups have, for reasons other than what was being taught in school, were creating groups and cells and terrorist organizations and so on and so forth. So it is true that they were funding a lot of schools and so on, a lot of pondoks, pasantrens, madrasas in the entire region.
So that's Haziq Jani from the Rajaratnam School of International Studies speaking about some of the real challenges for the Saudi government, even with their good intentions. Han, of course, you know, have you been keeping an eye on that terrible war in Yemen, which the Saudi Arabian government has been prosecuting? And I think, you know, again, with a lot of governments, we talked about India yesterday and its interest in counterterrorism, but countries like this also are involved in conflicts that often generate recruitment for precisely the kind of politics that those countries claim not to want, right? So with the Kashmir problem in India, and then, of course, with Yemen and such in, you know, in that part of the world. So, yeah, they're not making friends, and they're certainly generating a lot of anger on the ground.
Yeah, but, you know, yet when you look at these kind of initiatives, and in this one in particular, it's the opening of that counter-terrorism center here in Malaysia by Saudi Arabia. Yeah, funding is one thing. You know, like you said, there appears to be a gulf between the intention.
You do love your puns,
oh,
don't
man,
you?
Oh, man, it's okay. Not bad. You know, but
were you just congratulating yourself?
Yes,
nine minutes past six.
Again, because, you know, I feel that these puns are underappreciated, so I think it's about developing market.
Let's carry on.
That gap between their intentions versus, you know, what's actually being executed on the ground, right? And what's happening at the grassroots level. And then also the question then is that kind of soft power approach enough to, again, stem that tide of, IS and Daesh ideology here?
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Now, also today on the BBC show, we look at President Trump's preparations for talks with China's President Xi Jinping We hear from the editor of the Financial Times, Lionel Barber, who warns that Mr. Trump's threat to go it alone in tackling North Korea if Beijing refuses to help is a dangerous one. So there we have that issue, a geopolitical issue, being discussed on the BBC show, which starts at about 9:30. And also discussions of U.S.-China trade talks and how that is going to go. Interesting developments there, because Xi Jinping has come out as the defender of free trade. In a curious kind of historic turnaround with, with the kind of America First rhetoric coming from Donald Trump. So just a quick look at the news overnight as we slept. An attack on a metro in St. Petersburg in Russia. The St. Petersburg is the hometown of President Vladimir Putin. 11 people, in the latest news that I could find, 11 people have been declared dead as a result, and 45 injured in an explosion between two underground stations. Understand from Russia's National Anti-Terrorist Committee that another explosive device was found, and that was neutralized. We also heard from the Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev that the explosion was a terrorist attack, though I believe President Vladimir Putin has been more circumspect, saying that they don't rule out the possibility of a terrorist attack and they're looking into the case.
Yeah, no, and once again, this is yet another attack on the transportation system in Russia. You know, you go back to, say, 2013, suicide bombers killed 31 people in Volgograd. 2011, there was a bombing at an airport in Moscow. 2010 as well, Moscow. 2009, on a train from Moscow to Petersburg. You know, each of these attacks claiming anywhere from 27 to 38 people. You know, so there have been repeated attempts, targeting the transport infrastructure in Russia.
Yeah. So the thing is, in all the cases that you cite, it was Moscow, and I believe Moscow has been the victim of many of these attacks. Not St. Petersburg. This is the first time that St. Petersburg has suffered from a terror attack, and if it just turns out to be a terror attack, that apparently has shocked. People of St. Petersburg, and in reports yesterday, much of the despair came from a recognition that they were not safe, that, you know, while it was happening in Moscow, it has in fact reached St. Petersburg, which is the second largest city in the Russian Federation.
Right, and then if you look at, just neighboring Europe, right, and the numerous instances that they have, you know, even just recently, the numerous instances of terror-related attacks. Obviously, the most pronounced one was the one in London, right? Just a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, it really begs the question, and it goes back to what will be discussed on our current affairs, you know, today, whether all these various efforts by the various governments, you know, I mean, are they just one, two steps behind? And, you know, can there ever be this proactive, you know, measure to really stop the halt of, you know, these kind of terrorist incidents, and also the spread of the ideology associated with it, right?
Right. Lots to discuss on that score. Looking elsewhere, elections around the world, we had results in Serbia and Ecuador. In Serbia, the Serbian Prime Minister Aleksandar Vučić has won a clear victory. It's interesting because he's also an ally of Putin. He's pro-EU, but he also wants to maintain traditional ties with Russia and China. That was his platform. He won an overwhelming 55% with the second person in the running, only in the teens in terms of percentage points. Some are concerned about his authoritarian ways. In Ecuador, a leftist candidate, Lenin Moreno, won the Ecuadorian presidential elections. This, of course, is an interesting turnaround for a drift towards the right in Latin America. So this is kind of pull back towards center-left parties there. Though the losing opposition candidate, Guillermo Lasso, says that he will contest the vote count. He's saying he doesn't believe it's accurate. He also says that he wants to evict WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange from the Ecuadorian embassy in London. That would have happened if he had come to power. So fascinating stuff. We'll be back with more after this. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, The Morning Run continues, and that was Life in the Fast Lane by the Eagles. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Tan Chung Han, or Han as we call him, simply.
So sassy.
Yeah.
That's not you, Sharad.
Well, I think it's that 70s mood that the Eagles puts me in. That song, by the way, was recorded and released in 1976. I was 10. You were but a twinkle in your mother and daddy's eyes.
That's a nice job.
Were they even married at that point?
No.
They weren't even married. Yeah. So
you just age yourself there, Sharad.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't mind. I mean, I embrace. I think youth is overrated. As Raisa Gorbachev once said, you know, youth is a mistake you only need to make once.
Whatever makes you happy.
Yeah, Raisa Gorbachev knew things, you know. Yeah. Anyway, this was part of the Hotel California album, because nobody who, you know, ever in Malaysia would not know Hotel California as a song.
Correct.
They might not know the album. This particular was the third single, and that was released from the album. Peaked at number 11 on the Billboard Hot 100, 1976.
I would assume this was on vinyl. Have cassette tapes made their
way in 76? That's a very interesting question. I think by the late 70s, for sure, because I remember getting my first, tape machine thing. And I think at that time, there were several things. You had those tapes, but you also had those large cartridges. Remember those big...
Beta?
Not for video, but for audio.
Bigger cassette tapes?
Yeah, but anyway, those were eclipsed by the smaller TDK and Touch.
Well, if you would indulge me here, a quick Google check showed that the cassette tapes were introduced in America in November 1964. So about a dozen years before the release of that song.
Yeah, but I guess, yes, this songs and the album would have been released on vinyl, and, you know, vinyl having that old soft sound. Anyway, so moving on from
what
music.
What show have we become over there?
I don't know. I just thought it was so interesting. Anyway, there's more international news. South Africa's credit rating has been cut to junk status by the ratings agency S&P Global, the Standard & Poor's. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's part of the kind of volatile political situation there. We had President Jacob Zuma, awash with all kinds of controversies, including that building of some luxury house funded by some Indian entrepreneurs and all this. I mean, not South African Indian, I mean like Indian, money bags. And so, and the question that's being asked, I think, Han, about South Africa is whether the ANC is either set to be to split over some of the decisions. He had a late night cabinet reshuffle just a couple of days ago, or whether this signals really the demise of the ANC as a political force.
And part of that reshuffle actually resulted in the sacking of South Africa's finance minister, Pravin Gordhan. So, SNP is citing the political upheaval factor, right, behind, or as one of the reasons behind that credit rating downgrade. And now, just to bring it back home to Malaysia here, now, just to be absolutely clear, S&P, Moody's, and basically all three major credit rating agencies have Malaysia on a stable outlook. You know, they have maintained our sovereign credit ratings, you know, when it became due for review, you know, over the last couple of years. You know, and also one of the things that they have mentioned or alluded to is the policy continuity that we have here in Malaysia. Now, obviously, you know, we know among our BFM listeners, you know, that the fact that BN has been in power for decades, does not, at least in their eyes, may not signal, a robust democracy, so to speak. But at the same time, when looking at it from a credit ratings agency's perspective, they see this as, you know, policy continuity is important because then foreign investors know what kind of policies that they have, and they know that the policies will be in place for the foreseeable future, and they know how to make those investment decisions around it. Say, as opposed to like the stark contrast that we see in the States, right? You have the Obama administration policies, and many of them making this complete 180 when Donald Trump came in, went into the White House, right? So I think what we are seeing in South Africa here is once again another example of why policy continuity is very important, especially in the eyes of the international investment community.
Right. Because the other point of view, of course, is the South African public. And I think it's been voting against steadily against the ANC. There have been gains by opposition parties, municipal elections and such over the last couple of years. So, a party with such an amazing heritage, brought South Africa out of apartheid, now suffering the ignominy of not being able to hold it together once in power, because they have been in power for a very long time now. And so, that often leads to problems, just the sheer fact of being in power for so long.
Yeah, and also something I want to highlight here from this story is that SNP also expressed concern over the level of debt that the South African government had, and in particular the expense of supporting their state energy firm, Eskom. Now, once again, there are similarities there. While on one hand, say the prospects of policy continuity, are in place, for Malaysia, by the same time, the levels of government debt in Malaysia has reach the self-imposed limit of about 55% to GDP, and also perhaps the contingent liabilities. That's a phrase that has been used by Fitch, for example. That may have been a cause for concern, but ultimately is whether the government can, the Malaysian government, that is, can manage those rising debt levels while at the same time, temper those concerns over contingent liabilities. I think that'll be key for us.
Right. So with contingent liabilities, the ratio, debt ratio, goes above the 55%. Is that the concern?
There is a there are somewhat two different line items, so to speak. So there is that 55%, though, we set it ourselves. Just in the name of being more financially prudent. But it is hitting that pretty close to that level, 55%.
Right. So the RAND also suffering as a consequence of all this upheaval in government. I think with the sacking of the finance minister, the RAND suffered a 4% fall, and now it's again more pressure. I think it's gone down 2% against the dollar. Anyway, a lot of the issues that I believe we're going to be taking up later on in the morning. Now, just very quickly, just looking at some cultural issues and how money is being spent. A story from the New York Times says the internet might be saving culture, not, as some people have alleged, killing it. And that's because of the way people are finally spending money on the net. And apparently in the last few years, and with greater intensity in the last 12 months, people have started paying for online content. And is doing it at such an accelerated pace that this is going to have consequences for the kinds of things that are out there in the world, available online, and that could be kept alive by people actually paying for things. So instead of just Googling things and being interested in the world, you also say, I want to support it, and you put money behind your interest.
Now, but then the question would be, moving forward, is that growth sustainable? And because, yes, because you could argue that the reason this is making news is because it's coming from this low base effect, right? Essentially, in recent past, many netizens were not accustomed to paying for online content, but then now they are. So, is this just a once-off phenomenon, or is this just a short burst of activity, or, does this mark a paradigm shift in, how we actually go about, consuming content online?
Right. So what the New York Times article suggests that, in fact, what we're seeing is a shift, saying that, this trend has been in the making for a couple of years and has been accelerated. The question really is, in a country like Malaysia, and you think about minority cultures, if you think about subcultures, and minority, I don't mean just in ethnic sense, but any kind of culture that doesn't have a huge group of people support it, how do you sustain it? I mean, you know, in large countries, this is not a problem. You might be a minority of 10 million, you know what I mean? And you can find the economies that will make sense to keeping any kind of culture alive. A little jazz club could survive just because the sheer number that it's drawing from. But in a small country like Malaysia, you know, tiny subcultures have a struggle to survive.
And the question is, really, will the internet be their saving grace? You know, because, I mean, again, when you're propelling all these microcultures, so to speak, onto the global stage where it's this one massive marketplace, you're going to be fighting for limited resources and attention, right? So, you know, whether it's, you know, going to be saved by the internet, who knows?
I think it's a fascinating question, something we should revisit very soon. But first, we have the first bulletin of the day with Lynn Mark, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run. That was Blues from a Gun by the Jesus and Mary Chain. A Scottish alternative band formed in 1983. I bet you were born by then, Han.
That was the exact year I was born, yes. Okay. So you get 2 points there. Well done.
Okay, Tan Chung Han. Myself, Sharad Kutin, here with you and all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning.
Now, we are really digging the archives here for these kind of music, the songs that we've been playing this morning.
Yeah, we're going to have to ask the person who directs our musical choice to find out why, you know, if this the music most appropriate to
wake us up to.
Yeah. For those of you who are waking up or on your way to work, driving your kids to school, is this the kind of music that you like to listen to?
I mean, come on. Who doesn't want to listen to a Scottish alternative? Yeah.
It was nice. It was quite soothing. So, okay.
Soothing?
Tell us about the kind of music that you like to listen to at this, part of the hour, the morning stretch, as we call it. BFM, you can tweet us at BFM Radio, or you can text us at 016-201-9000. That's 016-201-9000. Tell us about the music you prefer to wake up to or drive to work to or take your kids to.
Anything Scottish. To. Oh, yes, most definitely. Anything Scottish.
What's wrong with Scots? Okay. Talking about choice, Han, people have, you know, in an experiment that was done by the American National Bureau of Economic Research, looking at flexi time or flexible schedules of, and whether people, would trade for that. So a lot of people say, yes, of course they want flexibility in terms of, scheduling their work. But when asked if they would trade it for money, basically, would they take a pay cut to have that increased flexibility? An overwhelming number of them said no. In this one research paper, okay, so it might not be representative of everybody. Certainly not a Malaysian research paper. And so I'm wondering how Malaysians think about issues of scheduling and pay and whether they would give up one for the other.
Now, you would think that, like you mentioned, this is just one study. Now, perhaps we can kind of break it down on one hand, whether you take less pay, and then secondly, whether you even want flexi time. Now, perhaps if I may, we'll start with the flexi time component of it. Now, I mean, I would think that would be industry specific, right? Because, say, in our line of work, where we have to go on air from 6 to 10, right? So that's non-negotiable. So obviously, flexi time is not something that is very feasible, in the media space, right? At least not in the broadcast space. I would think that perhaps that may be extended to our counterparts in the print world, maybe. But then if, these print outlets are having to rely on a certain number of articles and a certain number of pages on their, for their publication by the weekend or for the day, I wonder how feasible, offering flexi time to the employees would be. So again, I think this is pretty industry specific, right?
So what industries do you think would really have that? that as a possibility that, you know, that employers might even think this is a great idea.
Right. And then, my again, I haven't really given a lot of time or dedicated a lot of thought to this. You know, but I would think that these particular roles or responsibilities would be low demand, perhaps more low-skill
okay,
work,
so,
right?
Okay, I'm thinking things like data entry. So, like, you could do it at home, you could do it at your leisure, as long as you have some sort of KPIs, like you have to finish X number of forms
right.
by a certain amount of time, and you know, but you could start whenever you want in the day, you can work as intensely or
right.
as leisurely at a leisurely pace, depending on how you want to, you know, structure your day. I think it would be that kind of thing.
Right.
Perhaps, you know, something that's online that doesn't require interaction with clients and customers, maybe.
Yeah, well, perhaps. No, but then, yeah, and so if you, you know, think about it a couple of steps further, and then if you move up the value chain, so to speak, you know, if you are required to be more productive, you know, hence there will be more commitments placed on you, right? And so, and more commitments may, well, usually translates into more deadlines, etc. So again, I wonder how you know how popular flexi time is as a concept, you know, for the entire workforce.
Okay, so we look at it in kind of an abstract sense and say, ooh, take it away from the
pragmatic.
You're concerned about the industry specific nature of the question, right? Mm. But if you're just talking about whether you want to have flexibility in scheduling your time, I imagine most people will think this is a great idea because it gives you more autonomy. It gives you and empowers you to shape your day. I mean, some of us might find that terrifying. Some of us are structure people and, you know, find
right.
structure very secure, a kind of secure space in which to work. Say, I know when I have to start. I know when I have to end. And I don't have the discipline to structure my own day. So I'm kind of happy to have external structures imposed on me.
Right.
But what about those who don't, who actually think this is kind of freedom?
Right. Well, I mean, freedom, or you could interpret it as time to attend to your other commitments. So, for example, if let's say you're a parent, you know, flexi time would work for you. You know, at one of my former places of work, you know, this was somewhat an unwritten rule, really, flexi time, whereby moms, you know, were able to, you know, pick up the kids from school when they were sick, you know, no questions asked, or, you know, take them to the doctors and whatnot, etc. Right. You know, and I mean, just to set the context, I was working in that core team, four other moms, and then you got me. I was like, talk about contrast. You know, but then, yeah, so I think that could work for those who have other commitments that you have to tend to, or perhaps on the opposite end of the spectrum, perhaps those who are in the, you know, very exploratory phase of their lives, right? Where they maybe are trying to discover themselves or find new activities, new groups of friends, etc. So that might work for them. But I think by and large, though, for those of us who have been in the workforce for a while, we know our routines. You know, will flexi time really add or really enrich our lives? Because, I mean, look, let's be honest here. There are only so many things you can do in the Klang Valley. It's not like you can just go sit out in the sun at 2 p.m. on a Wednesday afternoon. You know, it's not something that we really indulge in now, would we?
Okay, let's just, you're absolutely right. I just want to say, so the twist here, or the rub here is, would you, if you were given this opportunity to have the flexibility in terms of scheduling your time, would you take that but also agree to a cut in wages? And that is the thing.
Okay.
So if a wage cut is what this is all predicated on, would you say yes to flexi time?
Me personally?
Yeah,
no.
How, you personally? No,
no,
you wouldn't. Why? Okay, so that's the thing.
I guess I'm stereotypically Asian that way. I don't know. But again,
why is it an Asian issue? Why is it just...
Because generally we are workaholics, right? But I mean, although apparently to this
speak
national...
Speak for yourself.
I know. Apparently, according to this working paper by the National Bureau of Economic Research, I know I'm not alone. Even apparently Americans are saying the same thing, right? They're not willing to take a pay cut for this flexi time. Right?
Yeah. Okay.
But isn't it asking too much though? Like, you can't have it all. You can't have both flexi time and you know, maintain your pay as it is.
Yeah, so this is the thing, right? So we have these ideals about the kind of lives we want to lead, and the kind of structures that would enable these dreams of freedom and, you know, self empowerment or self actualization or whatever you have it. But at the same time, the realities. Why wouldn't you take a pay cut in order to gain more freedom? I mean, what is that that's stopping you?
Because that would assume, I mean, it would assume that you still have plenty, you know, ample leisure time to then spend that money anyways, you know. So, and when you have those hours, you know, you can have more money or get more, or at least the equal amount of money as opposed to a pay cut to then go about with your lifestyle, right? I mean, so I throw the question back to you then. Would you take a pay cut for flexi time?
At this stage in my life, yes, I think I would.
Because you're rich already, lah. That's why.
Not rich, but, you know, it's also where I am in my life, you know. And I think the question, or it's an existential one, right? You're thinking about, because you have X number of hours in a day, and it's not just about, you know, indulging in your leisure activities. It's about saying, what is this life about? Is it all about work? And after all, the money that you make and the things you buy with it, you can't take with you once you're dead. And so you really do want to focus on quality of life. And that could be spending time with your kids, or in my case, spending time with my mother as a parent, or, you know, relatives or my friends. And that, you know, requires time. And time, if that means money, why not, right? I mean, after all, if it's not too dramatic a cut, it might be worth it.
Now, I will say that perhaps one argument for flexi time, at least for the younger folk, is that, I mean, generally speaking, I'm using broad brushes here, you know, we tend to work in spurts, you know, so having flexi time would then allow us to work according to, you know, when those, you know, bursts of motivation actually, you know, kick in, as opposed to having to overcome that inertia of having to wake up at, you know, 4:30 a.m., you know, or 4 a.m. for some of us morning folk here at BFM. You know, so I can see the value in that, but I think if to just make it black and white, no, I will not take a pay cut for flexi time.
Okay, we have the news coming up at the top of the hour, but first, here's something from the 80s, the late 80s, or the 90s, in fact. And I think the band Stone Temple Pilots was formed in the late 80s, in 89. But okay, the song Interstate Love Song by the Stone Temple Pilots, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.